I think I can do that. I can't remember how I did it, but.
I clicked on our names, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if I.
I know, I was thinking that we should have had some provision for this.
Oh, I see.
Should have had some provision for how the Skype people could send in questions.
It seems easy to just instant it like that if you can find it.
Yeah, no, it is true that it's easy.
Maybe she can talk her question.
Yeah, I've got it.
You got it, great.
It's actually, okay, so when we get to the questions.
Thank you.
You ready?
Yep.
Who's on Skype? Is Nancy and is Amy here?
No, Amy is not coming till tomorrow, but Jay is on.
Nancy and Jay. Okay. All right, so I'll talk for a while and then I'll try not to go on and on because there are like quite a few questions.
I can tell you the time.
Some of which I can actually answer, I think. So. you could give me a, what, supposed to do after a half an hour, why don't you say, think about stopping or something. Okay. Yeah. All right, so then I can like think about when to stop in relation to stop. Okay, so when we were talking about like Nagarjuna saying that dependent arising and emptiness have the same import with the middle way, that they have the same import with one another, somehow that things being radically empty of any graspable essential nature, any kind of way of existing on their own side or in and of themselves, somehow this cashes out to being like just what's needed for them to work and flow and interact the way they are, rather than something that contradicts that. And using, you know, that Tsongkhapa, you know, says, well, we should actually use the idea of, since these two things have the same import and people have some sense of what dependent arising means, maybe we should like use dependent arising to help us meditate on emptiness. And so you can have the idea of saying, you know, the schoolhouse here is, you know, empty of intrinsic existence because it is a dependent arising. It's like, well, when, you know, if you were here when Geshe Wangyal was building the building like you were, then you can look at the ceiling and say, oh, then he put this siding up here because he likes siding. And then you see like all the parts that go together and you remember like all the different work and ideas. And like you there's a story and a history of conditions like that are related to each part. So it doesn't so strongly appear to you as something that like naturally is like just spontaneously arisen out of the ground. Have you, like, if you go to Kathmandu, you know, and they have this idea there in the kind of Hindu Buddhist matrix of Nepalese religion that they're like little, you know, Buddha images or Hindu Deva images that like rise up out of the ground by them spontaneously. And some of them are like only partway up out of the ground. They're still coming up, you know, they're kind of sprouting up out of the ground. That's interesting, you know. And so, you know, so if we haven't, you know, been here when, and we're just like, whoa, you know, there's like something, something has arisen, you know, it's like there's appeared something that like appears to be just like, naturally there and kind of impressively set up from its own side. But you know, I don't, I mean, this is a pretty impressive building, but we could imagine a more impressive one, you know, and think about like let's say a fantastic, you know, multi-million dollar project in the city, or Donald Trump has decided to build the best museum of modern art that will outshine the Museum of Modern Art and make it, you know, look paltry by comparison because he's going to spend billions on it, right? Or something like that. It's like, and then it arises up out of the ground, and then the people come and it's like, it's just luminous and seems to be like naturally there and set up from its own side with this impressive quality of being. And it doesn't necessarily disclose, especially after a period of time and it's part of the landscape, like it seems to be just like naturally there from its own side. This is what I was like, just even if we leave aside like impressive buildings, we could just say, oh, I come into the room and I see the table and it just seems to be here. It seems to like just have a way of naturally being here. Like it doesn't depend on anything. Like when I look at it, it doesn't disclose to me anything about its dependence on parts and anything about its history of conditioning. It doesn't even look like something that I'm involved with in any way. Like that it doesn't, you know, need me to think of it as a table in order to be a table. It just seems to be like these like gods that are self-arisen out of the ground. It's just like it's independently by its own power seems to be arisen here, right? So we can think about, well, things that appear to be just set up from their own side are tricking us. That is, like, we can understand that they are actually dependent arisings, and we can reflect upon, oh, well, there had to be, like, for this building to be here, there had to be, like, so many causes and conditions, not just all the people and materials coming together in the effort over a long period of time, but then all the precursors to that and the precursors to that, you know? And it's like this, all these different conditions that go out in all these different directions. This is like, somebody made a joke the other day. It's like, because everybody like writes a book, and then when they write a book, they realize like that they can't even begin to trace all the conditions that went into writing the book. And the book probably talks about dependent arising. And then the book itself is a dependent arising. And it's an instance of how the reader picks up the book and says, oh, there's a book. And it's like, yeah, but the person who wrote the book knows that this book comes from millions of things that they can't even begin to all track down. It's like, I'll never thank everybody. That's right, you won't. Yeah. That's right, because there's no end to the number of causes and conditions that were required, right? And somebody made a joke the other day to say, what we need is a history of introductions to Buddhist books and how they use the concept of dependent arising in the acknowledgement sections. So we can use this idea of dependent arising, you know, to get started on thinking about how things don't exist in the way they present themselves to us, that they present themselves forcefully as though they held their own entity, were there from their own side, that they don't disclose how they depend on their parts and so forth. And yet, when we stop to think about it, even for a moment, this like quickly seems implausible, and we were wondering, it's like, why does it always keep looking like this to us, even though when we think about it for a minute, we realize it's not true. And when I talk about this, it's like, well, sometimes it's not just me. I mean, they say phenomena are deceptive, that these phenomena appear to us in a false way. They're luo, which means deceptive. They don't look the way they are. They have some way of existing. Their ultimate nature is ungraspable and empty. Yet somehow they manage to exist as dependent arisings, but it's not at all in the way they present themselves. They don't, you know, disclose all their interconnectedness in the way they appear. So we call them deceptive, which is like blaming them, those liars, you know, those bad, dirty, conventional phenomena, you know, keep tricking me. You know, but of course that's like, you know, imputing the fault, you know, to somewhere that it's like, well, it's not actually the phenomenon. It's like the mind. We have a quality in our mind that is, and so there's a way of talking about this. You're talking about the break and saying, well, conventional truths like these ordinary conventional phenomena, we call them conventional truths. But another way of talking about that word is say, they're, you know, truths for ignorance, or which is like saying they're not really truths at all. They're deceptive phenomena. They're fool's gold. It's like that's the kind of, what kind of gold are they? What kind of truths are they? They're, you know, they're fool's gold, or truths for an idiot, truths for a stupid, deluded mind that would take them as existing as they appear, when in fact they don't at all exist the way they appear. which, as we were saying, doesn't mean they don't exist at all. But they don't at all exist in the way that they're presenting themselves as having their own nature from their own side. They exist in some other way, which is like sort of we haven't threaded that apart and identified that. Mm. So, yeah, that's what it thinks. Things exist conventionally. With the deceptiveness about how they appear is coming from, you know, our own mind that is deluded in seeing them in some way other than how they really exist. Now, Tsongkhapa really emphasizes that when we analyze these phenomena and we look for them, and this is what I was talking about before, and we find that they're unfindable, we discover that no matter how we search, we can't find anything there on the side of the object, that refutes, as I said, I think before, this refutes any such nature or being or kind of existence. It refutes anything about the object having any way of existing such as would be findable in that way. That is, if I say of the cup, what is this cup really? And I can't find anything, Tsongkhapa says, that doesn't prove that the cup isn't there. Like, what are you drinking out of? It's like, it proves the cup doesn't have the kind of existence you think it has, because you sort of reflexively feel, or it looks like it has some existence out there that's set up from its own side such that when you went to look, you ought to be able to find. And when you do look, and you look carefully, you don't find. And so then you're surprised, and you think, oh, that must eliminate the cup. But still, you have something to drink out of. So he says, what's being eliminated when you can't find a cup and you search among the bases of it, the bases of parts of the cup, and you look for, like, what is the real cup here, and you don't find anything? What that is refuting is a cup such as would be findable under that kind of analysis or that kind of interrogation of its ultimate ontological status. You have no cup such as can answer to the question, what is the cup really? But when I want to know what to drink out of, I don't need to know what is the cup really. I just need to know, you know, whether it's a book or a cup. Do you know what I'm saying? So who wants to bother with this ultimate analysis? It's always just mucking things up and making things difficult for me. Well, of course it would be, you know, it's like if you was like always going around saying, well, is this empty or is this, you know, I want to find the non-empty cup to drink out of, then you would have like a really serious problem, right? But if you can say, well, the fact that we don't find a cup when we search for it doesn't like destroy the fact that there's some kind of thing there that we call a cup that out of which we can drink, right? Then we don't have a problem, and we can still distinguish in some way, which we haven't gone into detail, but in some way we can say, you know, well, it's okay to say that this is a book and this is a cup, even though equally each is completely empty of any findable nature as that. This is like, this may be one of the, there's certain key crucial acts of genius that make Tsongkhapa's 1402 book what it is, you know. One is saying, you know, it's not a matter of stop not thinking. It's true that Buddhas don't have thoughts. They don't have conceptual thoughts. They don't have any sense of dualism whatsoever. And it's true that we want to become Buddhas. But becoming the next step between here and there is not to like knock yourself on the head with a hammer so you'll be thinking less. And it's like, okay, that's one point. You have to use analysis. You have to use the tools that we have now as best we can to like progress to a point where we can have this non-dualistic understanding later. Okay, that's one. A second act of genius, we talked about this morning, is this idea that not all analysis of things that is important and useful in the path immediately reduces things to emptiness. We have to be able to talk about which potato to plant and which potato to eat, you know. We have to be able to like think at the conventional level and make practical distinctions, use reasoning and analysis as part of the path. As long as you're not going to like knock ourselves on a hammer and stop thinking. So while we're thinking, we should do some analysis that doesn't reduce, flatten everything out to its equality as utterly devoid of findable nature. but looks and that analyzes within the conventional and says, yeah, this comes from a million different causes and conditions that trace it back, and this comes from all different causes and conditions that trace back, but it doesn't mean that they're exactly the same in terms of what would be the most helpful thing for me to do right now. Mm. So that's two. And the third, you know, this we'll have one more, but I think the third thing that we can say, and this is, you know, it depends on how you look at it, maybe the most important, because there was so much confusion over it before. And that is this, is to say that, you know, when that ultimate analysis that interrogates the nature of something and, you know, deconstructs it and says, like, what is it really? And then is unable to find anything at the end of that analysis except only the emptiness, you know, of the nature it was searching for, that this does not refute things. It refutes things as such as would be findable in when looked for in that way. And this took me a long time to like figure out, okay, yeah, but they're saying that's the ultimate nature of the thing. So wouldn't that still mean that, you know, finally the thing, you know, doesn't exist? Well, in emptiness, there is no eye, no ear, no tongue. It's like from the point of view of ultimate reality, when you ask the question, what is it really? You're asking about a final graspable ontological status, a nature that would be graspable when you search within it. Yeah, you're going to come up with nothing. But that doesn't destroy the fact that things do merely, in some fashion, manage to exist and interact and flow. It's true, the kind of existence they have is going to be something different from what they appear to us to have and what we usually kind of go along with them having. But it doesn't seem to like destroy them working. Now, Tsongkhapa gives an example about for how we can think of this as really helpful to me. And he says, we never see sounds no matter how closely we look. We never see sounds. In other words, so he's using the fact that we can see and we can hear, and we don't hear shapes and colors, and we don't see sounds. But the fact that no matter how closely you listen, you don't hear green, doesn't mean that green doesn't exist. Yeah, but I listened with ultimate closeness. I gave it the ultimate scrutiny in my ear. And yet the green was never audible. Now it's like, well, of course not, because you're that's the wrong information channel that you're trying to, you know, access. That data is not accessible along that channel. There are different kind of reliable channels for getting at kinds of information in the world, and the kind of thing that you're looking for is not findable in that kind of way. This is what he says. I'm making it up. He gives the difference between seeing and hearing as a way to think about how something being conventionally existent and something and yet not being found under analysis, that we can say that things exist conventionally even and have reliable knowledge about that, even though when we ask, yeah, but what are they really, and we go to search and analyze, there's not a shred of nature that's findable there on the side of the object, nothing, right? And it's like, well, yeah, but you asked the what is it really question. You didn't ask about whether it would be good to drink or not. You didn't ask about whether it would be helpful for sentient beings or not. You ask, what is its final ontological status? You know, and when you ask that question, you're always going to get the same answer. It's like it's empty, right? You're always going to get the same answer. But if you say, well, you know, would it be, you know, helpful for me to throw socks in Josh's face right now, you might get a different answer, right? You wouldn't always be the same answer. Sometimes it might be. Usually not. But there's some, it's possible, you know. So there's other kinds of examples so that's an example Tsongkhapa gave. It kind of like broke it open for me to like understand what they were trying to say. There's different kinds of reliable knowledge. Stuff that you can know reliably by looking in one way is not going to be visible or accessible, but that doesn't mean, you know, when you look the other way. And the fact that it's not findable when you look in one way doesn't mean that it's not there at all. It just means you haven't accessed the channel along which and in relationship to which that kind of object is established. So I made up other examples that sort of try, because to try to, you know, build off and play on that. Like, you know, you don't see stars very well when you look through microscopes. You don't see atoms very well when you look through telescopes. Okay, that's easy, right? You don't, like, if you're using the most careful and refined sociological analysis, sophisticated and right up to the moment, you don't discover the basic principles of quantum physics. Yeah, but this is the very best sociology. We must be able to find out everything. You know, the same thing. The physicists study the deepest, they say, you know, the deepest structures in the universe, but they don't actually find anything about group dynamics down there. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, well, because you didn't look at the relevant level of analysis. You're not used, there's different kinds of reliable knowledge that operate in different ways. If you're not like looking at the right scale, or you're not using the right instrument, then you're not going to see that kind of thing. Does that prove that kind of thing's not there? You know, no, it just proves it's not there in such a way as to be seen in that kind of way. So this is what Tsongkhapa is saying. He's basically saying ultimate analysis is a certain way, a certain mode of knowing the world. It's the answer to a certain kind of profound question, a really important question. That's the key to the door out of cyclic existence. And, you know, it's like if we don't see that from beginninglessly we've been reifying these things and imputing them as existing from their own side, and we don't get at the fact that through ultimate analysis that they have not a shred of that, then we'll never be liberated. But it doesn't mean it's the definitive and final answer to every possible question that you could possibly usefully know. That's the whole reason you have two sides of the path. You know, you have a compassion side. It's like, well, these sentient beings are all empty. Why should I bother with them? You know, it's like if they're, you know, it's like they're just like rocks in their degree of being completely devoid of any intrinsic nature whatsoever. Right? Which one to plant and which one to eat? Who cares? They're all empty. Right? So you have to have another way of knowing and thinking about things. And this is what he's saying is like there is reliable conventional knowledge which asks questions about things and analyzes things, doesn't just necessarily looks at the evidence, makes distinctions, but without reducing everything to emptiness by asking the, yeah, but what is it really question? Where then you could say everything collapses, right, into emptiness, and which, of course, is sometimes exactly what you want to do. So I don't have one final example of this. Is the one I made up as the title for the chapter, is thinking of it as two radio stations. You know, you have All Things Considered radio, which has like all the conventional phenomena in the universe like are constantly being talked about, and there's lots of important debates, and sometimes people get very angry, and because there's like, you know, strongly held opposite views about every possible imaginable thing. What do you call it? Like Jinieba, the diverse range of all the phenomena of the universe. Mm-hmm. How would you translate Jinieba?
Diversity.
The diversity. Phenomena. Yeah. The panoply of the 10,000 things, they say in Chinese, right? Like all these different things. Well, do you like chocolate or vanilla? We'll be debated this day, you know? Or like, when there's no end of the number of things that we can, you know, we can have different opinions about and debate about, and then sometimes get angry at the people who hold the other opinion, you know, within. And we've been on this channel. This is the only channel we know. We've been on this channel all the time that we have been on any channel. It's like, well, that's the channel, you know. And then somebody says, there's a little show comes on, All Things are just like, you know, it's like a little ad for, oh, by the way, did you know there's another channel on your radio dial? That would be like, you know, the Dharma Center channel, you know? And it's like, there's another, what are you talking about? Other channel. I don't think so. No, it's not possible. There's the channel. And so it's like, oh, well, you can get on this other channel. It's like, here's the instructions. And it's like, so it's like, if you go on the other channel, it's like all emptiness all the time radio. And they, everything is covered, but it's all the same. It's just, well, what about chocolate and vanilla? They're empty, you know? It's like everything is empty. It's like, oh, that's empty. That's empty. That's empty. This empty. Huh, that's interesting. On the other channel, they were saying that these were some really important differences between those two, that we should be very animated about. Trev should take up arms against those vanillaists. Their vanilla ways. And so it's like, though, on the emptiness channel, in other words, like you could say, it gives you a relaxing of your ontological grasping after the kind of, it doesn't mean that it doesn't destroy permanently or forever your ability to go back over to the other channel and hear about chocolate and vanilla. But now when you hear about it, you're like, I think those people are going a little overboard. Because it's true that chocolate and vanilla do taste different, but there's something about the way they're getting into that and feeling about the people they disagree with that's kind of out of tune with this idea that, like, ultimately all these things are ungraspable. I don't know, it could be a very important difference, you know, between chocolate and vanilla, like there is between, you know, harming someone and not harming someone. It makes a difference, right? But then, you know, it's still not that there's some essentially graspable reality there. And of course, that's like the way we are with self and other, right, as well. You know, there is me and there is you, and we are not the same person. But ultimately, there's no findable difference between the two of us. So if I go to the emptiness all the time, and I get to understand that that the kind of difference that I was grasping onto between me being really here and you being really out there isn't findable at all, and that there isn't any essential kind of existence and at all that separates me from you or makes me one with you either. There isn't any kind of essential existence that I can find at all. Then when I still come back to the other channel, it's like, well, maybe we have a basis for having a more practical approach to getting along with each other, because we're not, why? It's still, we could have real differences. I'm not saying like everything magically disappears. You have to do analysis at the conventional level to resolve conflicts and figure out how people get along. It's not just like emptiness is a magic wand that makes all these problems disappear. What it does is it makes the exacerbation of the problems by this reification and, you know, of like rigidification. It's not just that this person has done something wrong. No, they're naturally evil bastard who could be expected by virtue of their own built-in nature to behave in such a satanic way as to deserve complete annihilation, which I'll temporarily restrain myself from engaging in. You know, I was like, well, that's not going to be there when you let that part go. That's the idea. Oh, that would be a start. Yeah. Time? Okay, let me just show you a picture, and then we'll look at some questions. So, have you guys seen the rabbit duck? I just brought a rabbit duck. Could you, like, pass around rabbit ducks?
You can hold that in front of the Skype.
Have you seen that? Oh, you can Google rabbit duck, too. Higher. I can see it in the image.
I think your image. Oh,
you no, I can it, see huh? it. I have it right on the camera. Yeah. Rabbit, duck.
Rabbit,
duck. You see it?
Oh, yeah. I can't remember if I pressed record again.
You're moving. When you cock your head one way, it's a rabbit. Yes. And when you cock your head the other way, it's a duck. Is that what it is, Nancy?
I know.
I know.
Yeah.
You see, you've seen a rabbit, duck. Well, I guess they're passing it down.
I never see the rabbit.
The rabbit. The rabbit's.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah,
I finally got it. Being a birder, it's just like, that's a duck.
Right. Exactly. See, the conventional reality of things as like functioning and this arising in dependence on that, it's not like in the table there's like its ultimate emptiness and then there's like its ability to function at the conventional level as a table. And that we can, in any place, with the finest possible, you know, scalpel, like, divide these two apart. They're always exactly the same, right there together. That's why it's a hard sort of form is emptiness, emptiness is form. These are like, they're, you know, rabbit is duck, duck is rabbit. It's like, they're the same all the way down, except insofar as which channel you're looking on. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? So like all of this is part of the rabbit if it's Easter, and all of it's part of the duck if it's duck hunting season. They actually did this with some kids in Germany, and they showed some school kids the rabbit duck in the spring, and like 75% thought it was a rabbit, and then they showed it in the fall and 75% thought it was a duck. You know, it's like, or their first reaction was to say that, right? So we have a certain way of looking at things. So what am I saying? It's like for each and every entity that you can point at or think of in the universe, there is both thoroughly, all the way through it, inside and outside or upside, sheer emptiness, and its conventional nature as a basis or emptiness. Right? That's how the two truths is. Like, one time we were in, we did a book on conventional truth in Buddhist philosophy, and we were at this Buddhist institute in Kathmandu. It's kind of Kagyu Nyingma group, and we explained something like this about the two truths, and then they said, yeah, but how do you unite the two truths? And like, and Tom Tillemont said, well, didn't we just explain that they are like inseparable from the very beginning? You can't ever have one apart. Of course, what they meant was on the practice of the path. How do you bring together, you know, your understanding of conventional with your understanding of the ultimate? But as far as the way things are at the basis level, it's not like everything that exists is either a conventional reality or an ultimate reality. But it's not like the ultimate realities are over there in a special ultimate reality pure land. It's like ultimate reality. Oh, you thought I meant the pen was the ultimate reality. Of course not, you know. But there's no other place that emptiness is. It's right here. It's just that it's a different channel than we're using when we look at it and say pen. Pen is also right answer for the other channel. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like, okay, so that's the way it is. Now let's see what questions we have. The quote from the so-called Concentration Sutra that was quoted from the Three Tomes, is that quote in your book, Introduction to Emptiness? It is in my book, Introduction to Emptiness, but where is, I don't know exactly. Well, it's in a part that we have, oh, here it is. In the second edition of Introduction to Emptiness, that quote appears on page 102, is the answer.
I think the page numbers are the same in the first.
Is it? Oh, that would be nice. No, I don't think they're.
No. Oh, no. Wrong. Okay.
The name of the sutra is the Samadhi Raja Sutra, which is the, we translate it as King of Concentration Sutra. And it's quoted in the Great Treatise three times, and the first time is in volume 3, page 108. Okay, you mentioned some person named Harvey who had written about practice and psychotherapy. What is the full name? And there is the name of the text. His name is Harvey Aronson, and the book is called Buddhist Practice on Western Ground. Very good book. It deals with, like, I cited it just because I was talking about the difference between psychological idea of a self and kind of an ontological self that Buddhists are refuting. But it has also lots of good stuff about other issues, like thinking anger, especially because, you know, there's just as there's different ideas about self, then there's also different ideas about anger. And so Harvey has this interpretation of, you know, when Buddhists are very strongly against anger, he argues that, well, the kind of anger that they're criticizing is really kind of like malice in the sense of an intention to harm. And it's not just like that. Being outraged at injustice or something like that, but it's like having the propensity to hurt, a disposition to harm on the basis of anger. And so he has other kinds of things like that. They're very useful. And the other question was, when you referred to Nagarjuna's 18th verse of the 24th chapter, was that the fundamental wisdom text? Yes. What is the difference between patience and tolerance? patience we're using as a translation for serba, the third perfection. Maybe sometimes some other people will also use tolerance as a translation for the third perfection. Yeah. So it could be that if you're talking about specific, if you mean by patience and tolerance, the translation equivalents of Buddhist texts, patience and tolerance, it could very well be that there's no difference at all and that these are referring to the different translations of the same word. Some people do forbearance, some do tolerance, some do patience. If it's a broader question about like what is in general the difference between patience and tolerance, I could make something up. But okay, I think tolerance means you have to recognize that someone is actually different from you, and then have a way of accepting and dealing with that in a pluralistic context rather than trying to pretend that they're not different or try to force them to be the same. But in the first instance, accept that there is real difference and then be able to learn to live with that. So tolerance, in my way of using the word, is related to the ideal of a pluralistic society. Patience is much more, I think, in terms of like the opposite of anger. So it could be like something like the ability to, in the face of adverse circumstances, to not engender or to suppress an intention to harm, something like that. Yes, Karen.
I've been thinking about this a lot. And,
oh, wait a sec, Karen.
What?
You have to be on.
Well, this was my question.
You have to be on the microphone.
You interpreted tolerance in a different way than I was thinking, but it seems perfectly logical, as you say, recognizing that someone is different from you and accepting that. Both patience and tolerance have been mentioned as useful when someone has intention to harm you or does something that is not pleasant. So it's in that context that I'm thinking about the difference. And I have a little hypothesis that I don't know if it's right or not, but I think about tolerance when someone does something wrong or does bad karma to you. And patience when someone is doing the best they know how. And they, you sense more of an ability for them to overcome. But that could be all wet, because if someone's doing that karma, they also don't know better. But I was trying to make that distinction. I don't know.
I don't think that there's any, like, okay, internal to any Buddhist system that I'm aware of, there's no technical distinction such as you're referring to. But, I mean, there is this idea of forbearance, and sometimes that's patience in the sense of forbearance is used to, like, coping with situations where some people, where teachers have some students who are more challenging to train or work with than others. And sometimes when people are talking about patience in that sense, they use the term forbearance. But I don't know that I would personally make the distinction just the way you have, but there's obviously like a whole halo of connotations for these terms that overlap, and there isn't any like technical, it's not a technical difference. Okay, the next question is, does the latest understanding of physics supplant dependent arising? Well, I would say that my understanding of what people say about Stephen Hawking's new book on the Big Bang does seem like to not be in line with what I understand of dependent arising. But that might be all that I can like intelligently say about it. I mean, I could pretend that I know a lot more, but it's like basically, you know, the idea is dependent arising is like when is like how this arises from that, but without being findable in a way where you can say that that the cause is other or same or both same and other or neither the same nor other than the effect. And there were the people who are usually considered to be refuted when you say neither were materialists, who were also sometimes thought of as nihilists, who were another school of philosophy at the time of Buddha, called the Charvakas. And they said, well, you know, why are there thorns on rose bushes? Well, there just are. You know, you can't, it's, you know, stuff happens, man. It's like, you don't have to, like, have some, be able to posit some, like, cause, like, for each and everything. There's just the way of nature for some, this appears then, and that appears some other time. And it's like, okay, so that was considered to be not dependent arising, and was like one, usually what you think of as being refuted. And within my limited understanding, I mean, this is something like what I understand Stephen Hawking's book to be saying, not about tables or chairs or rose bushes, but about universes, that universes don't, you can't like say what the conditions are that give rise to a universe. Universes happen. Maybe it's not the case like that with rose bushes, but with universes, it's just like, well, that's the way things are. I don't even know whether, you can't say that's the way the universe is, because we're talking about where universes come from. It's like, instead of saying where the universe come, there must be, the universe must have come from God, you know, who exists, God in and of God's self, and doesn't depend on anything else. And it's like, in order, you know, not to avoid that idea, or avoid having to talk about something that exists outside the universe, which we can't imagine as a condition for the universe, he says, well, it's just like, that's the way things are. We can't even begin to discuss it. So that's all I can say about it. I have this sense that maybe that sort of aligns with the question a little bit, that maybe there is some divergence there, yeah. I can't really completely read this one. Is emptiness not all inclusive? I can read that part clearly. Is emptiness not all inclusive? Emptiness is every in Madhyamaka, everything is completely and utterly empty, including emptiness. That's a very important point, which we'll talk about more tomorrow. But like, there isn't anything that you can name that, or conceive of, that is non-empty. In fact, the whole idea of some non-empty thing is not just, it's not just something that happens to not be the case, but they consider it to be a sort of necessary, it's necessarily non-existent. It's impossible for there to be something non-empty. So emptiness is all-inclusive in a sense. It is that there is no non-empty thing. But you shouldn't think of it necessarily as like, oh, there's just one big emptiness that includes everything. It's more like whatever you can point at, if you say, what is it? It's final nature, it's emptiness. But, well, you know, so the emptiness of this is like exactly the same as the emptiness of this other thing, insofar as each is a utter lack and sheer lack, a mere lack of any intrinsic existence. But one is being posited in relationship to this bottle of water, and one is posited in relationship to the cup of tea. So they're not self-identical. I mean, when we think about them, we can say, how many emptinesses are? Well, there are as many as things that you can point at and think of. And it's like they're all of exactly the same flavor. But I think it's problematic to say, and therefore there's just one emptiness that includes everything. Because here's why. If you say there's just one emptiness, then the emptiness of emptiness is also the same. And that means emptiness is its own final nature. So I don't like that. That's why I don't like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think, you don't want anything that goes in the direction of saying emptiness is a self-existent monistic thing. It's better to say that there are an infinite or unimaginable number of emptinesses, like any time you think of anything and think of what is it really, you come only to emptiness, and not posit it as some big reality that includes everything. Here, You look at, meditate on this for a little while.
Okay. There's one on the screen here. But you can pick it up if you want.
I struggle with reconciling statements that emphasize the absolutely critical nature of understandings to teachings on emptiness. For example, there is no peace by another means, with His Holiness' statements about not converting from the religion we were raised in and the value of other religions and teachings. If there is no way to understand reality and thus optimize our ability to help others, it would seem that we do need to leave behind other religions and teachings. This ties into another question I struggle with. Many Westerners who practice Tibetan Buddhism are seemingly much more interested in ritualistic, meditative, and devotional practices and empowerments, and say that the analytical teachings like Lamrim are too cerebral for their temperament or that they can't relate to it. Have you heard His Holiness or other Gelugpa teachers give an answer to that? Okay. In regard to the first part of the question,
do you want me to take it back?
Not right now, because okay. I can see it. That's a really good question. I think that His Holiness is like very, very clear about this issue, and His teachings at Lehi were really excellent on it. He's very, I think, put off by efforts by people from one religion to like think that they have the truth that the other people need to get in order to be okay. And so when he spends a lot of time coming to the West and teaching to audiences of people who are not Buddhists, he's very sensitive to how that would be seen, because he knows how it is, you know, like when other people come to his communities with an evangelical attitude. So he doesn't want to be seen as doing the same kind of thing. He really thinks that there's, and he explained this carefully at Lehi, that there's like, that the most important thing for world peace is for people to cultivate a good heart and to find kindness and love, and that to develop this deeper and broader, and also to make commitments that are based on their traditional religion, and each day remind themselves of those commitments when they wake up, and at the end of the day evaluate themselves and review, you know, how well they did living up to those commitments that day. And make and regret those instances in which they didn't, and recommit themselves to doing better the next day. And that's what he's thinking, that like, well, we can have, if people all really live up to the best ethical principles of their respective existing religions in their respective existing communities, this is a way better way to promote happiness and world peace than suggesting, well, everybody's really got to realize emptiness. And then if he did say everybody's got to realize emptiness, whose emptiness would it be? Because let alone, you know, the Chinese or the Vietnamese or the Sri Lankans, not even the Sakyapas will agree about whether it's exactly the same emptiness as what the Dalai Lama's Gelugpa order is like saying that you should realize. You know, they'll have like a slightly different interpretation. So the Dalai Lama is like an exemplary pluralist in this sense. He's really saying that now the part of the question is saying, well, doesn't this contradict the idea that we won't become free from existence, we won't, cyclic existence, we won't find true spiritual peace unless we realize emptiness? Well, of course, he doesn't like budge off of that for a bit. On one hand, he's a pluralist, and on the other hand, he calls himself a staunch Buddhist. He used that phrase in English, right? He said, some people might call me a staunch Buddhist. And it's like, so he knows what that word means, and he's going to own it, you know, and say, look, I'm not backing down a bit from the idea that Buddhism has an analysis of the nature of things that is more profound than any of all these other religions that I'm, you know, saying are important as part of the world community of peace. And that ultimately, for people to be liberated from cyclic existence, they're going to have to realize emptiness. But it's not an emergency, you know. He's clear that he believes in many, 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 many lifetimes, you know. And he's like thinking, this is something that people will gradually come to, each in their own time, each in their own way. And That it's, and he also made this point, like, about the psychological and the cultural and the social difficulty of conversion. You know, he gave these examples at Lehigh of the one woman who just had been helped so much by the Christian missionaries that she felt that she had to become a Christian, but then she was so anguished about it that she came to His Holiness and said, "But I promise I'll be a Buddhist in the next lifetime." And he felt so sorry for her because it was like clear that she didn't really want to be a Christian, but she felt like an obligation to be a Christian in some sense. And then he's like gave a reciprocal example of a theosophist, you know, who abandoned all theism and moved to India and spent their whole life, you know, promoting Buddhist ideas, but then on her deathbed was like, you know, suddenly rediscovering her faith in God. And so he's like very much one to like think that we have to be quite careful about launching ourselves out of our thinking that we can like just launch ourselves out of all of our, that we're not subject to the conditioning of what went before in our own world, you know, and that it was, we can't just like accept, but if we become Buddhists, we become a certain kind of Buddhist that's going to be not like what the Tibetans were or the Sri Lankans were or something like that. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, well, you know, we're deriving our sense of Buddhism from the Tibetan tradition here, but it's like, well, it doesn't mean like we're going to become Tibetan in the way we do that. And so he did make allowance for that. You know, he said, well, even in Tibet, we had some Muslims and, you know, we had a few other people. And so it's not that everybody has to be, you know, part of, it's just like popular vote. Everybody in this country will be X. And then he's not for that. He's recognizing that if you try to convert to a religion that you have no cultural history with, and everybody in your family thinks is just like a scandal, then you're making a lot of problems for yourself and people who are close to you. And if it's not going to be the lifetime in which you realize emptiness anyway, then maybe it would be better for the cause of world peace and peace within your community to become really good at practicing, you know, the virtues that grow, that are closer to, you know, the people that you've grown up with or in your community. Yeah, that's his argument. You know, it's I think the answer in part to this is like it's premised on the idea of multiple lifetimes, and it's like not everybody is going to be realizing emptiness in this lifetime anyway, and that the most immediate thing is to cultivate ethics, right? So ethics for a new millennium is like, well, it's not just all the religions, whether you're religious or not, let's focus on identifying those resources for empathy and care that everybody has, and which we're taught how to nurture and strengthen by many different traditions, and not think, well, in order to be compassionate, I have to be a Buddhist, right? I guess that's the best I can do with that part. And the second part, I don't, you know, it's like Lamrim teachings, you know, when I think of Lamrim teachings per se, this Lamrim teaching is one thing. But, you know, Lamrim teachings per se, I think, are focused on the whole cultivation of virtue and not like they're not. I don't think that I think that many teachers would say that, like, you have to have a foundation in cultivating a virtue to properly be going on to doing tantric practice. But it's true that that's not always emphasized. And it's not just that the, you know, how sometimes that's not the way things really work. I guess I have to say that I've heard some teachers obviously think that's a problem, you know, and have made comments about it. You see, you know, some Westerners who are like, it's like these other practices are too low for a high person like me. It's not just Westerners, too. You could have other people. And it's like, what I need is to get, you know, the Hayagriva initiation or, you know, some other one. And then there's like people who collect initiations like trading cards or something like that. I don't know how they do all these different sadhana commitments. Yeah, and it seems like, just like I was talking about before, is obviously there's many people who have a great sense of lack of something, you know, missing inside that they want to try to fill up. And it, you know, there could be a kind of chasing dharma, that grasping after, you know, I'll be okay. And I was doing the orchard, but for some people, it's like the next initiation is the thing that's going to make them okay, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like that. That's me talking. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so.
You were asking.
Well, somebody, isn't it Nancy, I think. Huh?
Yeah, it was Nancy's.
Why did the, let's see. What is the definition and scope of emptiness in different schools of Buddhism? Well, in all the Madhyamaka schools, emptiness is understood as the lack of ultimate existence. Which means that when you, you know, say, what is this ultimately, or how does this really exist, and you search, that there's nothing that's finally findable. And there's disagreements within different types of Madhyamaka about other kinds of words, like whether things exist by way of their own intrinsic character and so forth. And we could talk about that more tomorrow. But like some people think that things have some kind of intrinsic nature or character of their own that exists only conventionally, and that ultimately they're all unfindable, but that they must have some kind of conventionally existent built-in nature of their own. And then other people say not. So then within lower systems, then there's an idea that things that with regard to something that exists, that when you say, what is it really, you ought to be able to find something at the back of it. It may not be the thing you started out with, because things have a kind of sense of being dependently imputed, but they're not dependently imputed into thin air. You know, they would say there has to be something real that's at the bottom of this imputation. So they might have different things that they say are, you know, really the basis. So some people, Chittamatra, might say, well, the foundational consciousness is something that, you know, does really exist. But in relationship to that, we impute some real, substantially existent person or truly existent person. A person doesn't truly exist in the way the person appears, because what the person really is like the continuation or streaming along of this foundational consciousness. Or other people, like we were talking about, might say that the person doesn't exist as in the Vaibhashika or Sautrantika would say that the person doesn't exist in this sort of substantial way that the person is ordinarily taken as existing, because when you look at the parts of the person, you find that, you know, the person is not the collection of the parts, or is not identifiable with any of these individual parts. But there has to be something real that's there that we call, like when we say we'll do the chariot, you know, tomorrow, but it's like somebody, they'll say, well, like, you know, there, a chariot is what we call a collection of chariot parts, but there have to be some actual parts there in relationship to which we've ascribed that chariot. So there's something there that's the basis of it. I think for a more detailed answer to that question, I would recommend my book, Appearance and Reality, which goes through all the different, like, traditional tenet systems and tries to use like exactly the right vocabulary for what each one accepts and refutes. Why did the Buddha teach emptiness and ultimate reality? Buddha taught emptiness and ultimate reality. Well, first of all, in the way Tsongkhapa is talking about, emptiness is ultimate reality, so it's the same thing. Buddha taught emptiness as the ultimate reality because, as I was saying earlier, this is the antidote. Understanding of this is the antidote to the basis for all unnecessary suffering in cyclic existence. We have all this pain and misery in cyclic existence, and we're drawn into it over and over again because we have this delusion that we exist naturally or objectively, and emptiness is showing that we lack such existence. So by understanding that lack, we're getting the thought which is contrary to and erodes the force of this delusion that's the root of cyclic existence. Why is a Mahayana motivation better than a Hinayana motivation? Okay, so in the Mahayana way of talking about these things, you know, a Mahayana motivation or Bodhisattva motivation is like seeking for the welfare, motivated by the welfare of all living beings. And Hinayana motivation is somebody who's also seeking liberation, but is doing it on the basis mainly of seeking their own welfare. So not exclusively. That is, you can have, like, Hinayana practitioners cultivate compassion, and they can have vast compassion. I mean, the whole, you know, it's not that it, not as though arhats don't have compassion or that people on the Hinayana path don't have compassion. It's just that there's not built into it this idea that the whole motivation for the practice of the path in the first place takes into account the welfare of all living beings, all right, and seeks the welfare of all living beings. And that's the why. So why is that superior? Well, one reason is that first of all, the idea in Mahayana is that we really true everyone has the Buddha nature. This is taught in the Lotus Sutra. So all living beings have the capacity to become full and completely enlightened Buddhas. So people, and that means they have capacity to become hugely powerful helpers of others. And the notion is that, like, because Hinayana practitioners are seeking mainly for their own welfare, they attain a kind of peace and isolation where they don't, even though they have compassion, they don't in the end maximize their capacities to be of assistance to others. And therefore, they don't fulfill their own highest potential. They've gone to an extreme. They sometimes talk about the extremes of cyclic existence and peace. If some people are attached to cyclic existence, that would be us. Some people are attached to nirvana, you know, and they just want to get out. God, this place sucks, you know. Just like, let me out, you know. And they have this intense kind of burning disenchantment, or, you know, even what, you know, worse than disillusion. They're so disillusioned and disenchanted that it's like they're on fire to escape from, you know, this world of afflicted conditioning. Do you see that Seinfeld where George Costanza, like, the house is actually on fire and he, like, knocks over a disabled woman and is rushed to get out of the house? Not only does he not help her, but he's actually like, get out of here. So this is like very, when we talk about Hinayana motivation here, we're not talking about any particular type of Buddhism in any particular part of the world, right? It doesn't, like, say, relate to Theravada necessarily, right? They're Theravada bodhisattvas, and they're Theravada who, at least would seem to me, have all the resources to meditate and realize emptiness. It doesn't have to do with Theravada, in my opinion. This is just like the idea of a certain kind of motivation that's like a motivation to practice the path that's not grounded in the bodhisattva's, you know, vast idea of what's possible in terms of transforming ourselves and helping others. Yeah. Is the time stop?
Oh, the time is.
Okay.
We have to dedicate now.
Okay, we're going to dedicate now. There are more questions, but we ran out of time.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
So, we have those two verses over there on the bottom that we recite for a dedication to share any merit that we've accrued today with all living beings. So, from left to right. I dedicate all this virtue to emulate the knowledge of the Hero Manjushri, and likewise Samantabhadra as well. With whatever dedication is praised as supreme by all the conquerors traversed the three times, I also dedicate all my roots of virtue for the sake of auspicious deeds.
Thank you.
How did you do it? Yeah, see you guys tomorrow.
Okay, well, I guess we'll see you tomorrow, are we?